Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson, and it's June 27th, 2016, or day two post-Brexit. And that's what we're going to discuss today. The vote to leave the EU by the UK, it sent shockwaves around the financial world. It's upended the political order and unleashed a wide range of emotions: shock, anger, glee, regret, anxiety, fear, hope. It all depends on which belief system you hold and whether that got supported or shattered. To help us make sense of the Brexit decision, we are very lucky today to be speaking with Axel Merk, president and chief investment officer and founder of Merk Funds. Axel's been with us before, and as you know, he is a noted expert on world currencies, manages several mutual funds that manage currency risk for investors. I bet he had an interesting Thursday night, as well as an equity fund and the Revolutionary Gold Fund that trades under the ticker symbol OUNZ, OUNZ. For years, he's been an outspoken critic of U.S. monetary policy, warning investors that the current course risks seriously devaluing the dollar. Can't wait to get his views on Brexit and that outlook. And he is also the author of Sustainable Wealth, a very, very readable, approachable guide to understanding our macroeconomic environment, the risks that today's investors face, and how they can manage their finances to achieve financial stability. Axel, thanks so much for taking time to join us today.
My pleasure.
So you would like me to comment on what's happening here in the world. And let me first say, you mentioned all these emotions. One of the roles that I see myself in is to get people thinking on the one hand. On the other hand, as far as I'm concerned myself, I see my primary role as not getting too emotionally involved and just accepting things. And sometimes people interpret that with me agreeing to one side or the other, but I just like to know, what the heck does it mean? What does it mean for my investments, and what does it mean for the future? And so to me, the Brexit vote has broken a taboo. Until now, when push came to shove, the intellectuals always won out. The reasonable argument as to why you should do something. Whereas in this case, the emotional argument has won out. The argument by Boris Johnson, the lead guy for the Brexit vote, says, let's take our country back. This is about the constitution, that we have control over things. That's far more powerful than the little details as to why it should be better to remain. And the implication here is that this isn't just relevant for the UK. This is relevant for our elections in the US. This is relevant for things happening in Europe. This is relevant for the Middle East. This is relevant for the rest of the world. Political stability around the world is on the decline. And this is kind of a huge wake-up call. And then on the other side of things, I was shocked when I talked to my friends who are not in the industry, how complacent they are, and think that, it's just another day and life will go on.
Well, interesting, you know, on your Twitter feed this morning, you said that, I'm quoting here, Brexit is a bit like a bikini, risque when first introduced, yet the onset of a cultural revolution. Hey, there's no 140 character limit on this show. Tell us more about what you meant there, a cultural revolution. That's a big statement.
Well, sometimes those flimsy things get more attention than the more profound things, I suppose. it goes into this theme that people are upset, and let's take the U.S. the folks who've been supporting Sanders or Trump, they have very valid concerns. The folks who want to leave the EU have very valid concerns about the EU. And they now they have spoken up, and the concerns have not been addressed. You can address these concerns with a left-leaning or a right-leaning mind, but both the quote establishment has not looked after the concerns of those things. And now this has broken out to the open. And now it is suddenly okay to say, no, let's tear this thing apart. And this may well happen. Now, the thing is, it might take us 100 years to put it back together in a more sensible way. But that is the road that we are on. And think about all of this happens in the context of asset prices being expensive. Earlier this year, we blamed the Chinese for the markets plunging. Now we're blaming the Brits for the markets plunging. Well, guess what? The markets have been due for a severe correction no matter what. And so now we got our excuse, so let's sell the hell out of it. Now, what does it have to do with a bikini? Well, not so much directly, of course, except that yes, this is a change in tone. It changes the fabric of how we look at things, that we no longer look at things rationally necessarily, but emotionally instead. And the reason I say rationally is because from a pure economic point of view, the headwinds that are going to be unleashed are rather severe. And at the same time, of course, if you're on the countryside in England, and that's where most of the folks supporting Brexit have come from, they didn't think about those issues. They don't give a darn about Wall Street. They don't give a darn about the City of London. They worry about what they think is right and what they think is wrong.
Now, this is fascinating because, you know, to me, I've spent a lot of time in the last 48 hours trying to understand this better, because I'll tell you, I was surprised. I thought given the fear tactics and the firepower of the stay or the remain side, I thought they had it in the bag. And like a lot of people, I was I very sleepless Thursday night as I was trying to figure out what this really meant. But I'm seeing now, I just had a conversation with a very smart gentleman yesterday, but he was really adopting this view that this was an unfortunate decision by ignorant people who had been played the race card and all this. But when I talk to people who are on the leave side directly, they say, no, this was about self-determination. This was about really being unhappy with the way the EU had been configured politically, very unhappy with the loss of self-determination and destiny, and really saying, no, we'd like to have some control back in our lives. To me, that seems reasonable and realistic, but the emotions are still thundering across the airwaves out there trying to paint this as a regrettable, unfortunate, bad, backwards decision. How do you see this?
Well, they're both right. The thing is, the grass isn't necessarily green on the other side. Think about any hot button issue in the U.S. And then suddenly Washington comes along and imposes something on you. And you're going to hate it. The world in politics, the way politics work is you take your favorite politician, and when something goes wrong, they never blame themselves. They blame the opposition, or more likely they blame somebody else. And in Europe, it's always been popular to blame Brussels for everything that's bad. That was 20 years already, and 25 or 30 years already, it's now. The thing is, the Brits have a bunch of problems of their own, and by being outside of the Union, it doesn't solve them. One of the things was immigration. Well, there are lots of Polish workers that have come to the UK and work for low wage and work very hard. Well, it kind of sounds similar to folks from Latin America coming into the US. Well, guess what? They're hardworking people and they contribute to the economy. Now, let's kick them out. That doesn't make the Brits more competitive suddenly. It doesn't solve many of the issues. The Brits have a major budget deficit. They have a major current account deficit. Maybe some of it improves with a weakening currency. They've had their own currency. But the issues aren't going away. And so, similarly, in the U.S., when you have a major disagreement with something, Texas not agreeing to what comes down from a Democratic administration, but what do you try to solve them locally, or do you try to leave the union? And if you were to leave, does that solve the issues that you have? And so the frustration is very well warranted. But the question is, what is the solution to these? And the European Union has shown that they don't have the institutional flexibility to address those. And so the Brits say, hey, let's cut the cord and let's do something else. That's kind of nice, but what the heck is this something else? And that's the problem, that there is the alternative hasn't been all that well planned out. And that's the sort of thing that we're getting. We're getting a rise in populist sentiment. That means we are fed up with the scientific or intellectual explanation of why the status quo is better than the alternative, and says, what the heck, we've had enough. And so in a world where that happens increasingly, we're going to elect more populist leaders. They're going to have more simple solutions. And in that process, we'll destroy many, many things. And hopefully we'll build something better. But let me kind of give you my not so rosy outlook. There is a reason why the Great Depression ended in World War II. Because as this happens throughout the world, the one thing that people want. They want to blame somebody else for all the mistakes that are out there. And one of the calls you've heard is, well, we got to ignite these economies again. We got to have more fiscal spending. And what happens in countries where you have a hung parliament or Congress? Well, if you can't get up fiscal spending by building bridges, roads, or walls, what you're going to do is you're going to build up military spending. You find an enemy. Then you're going to be able to justify the increased expenditure. I'm not saying that the U.S. is going to go to war, the U.K. is, but we have the same issues anywhere in the world. Think about the Chinese, the Japanese, the European Union, Africa, North America, South America. Somewhere there, I do see that we are moving towards an environment where political stability is on the decline. You have a rise of populist leaders, and the sort of choices that will be made are not necessarily going to be in the sphere that we have in recent years learned to become to be the rational ones. And so that has changed now. The taboo has been broken. We are now going to go towards the easy solution, and the easy solution might be rather rocky for the financial markets, where I'm mostly trying to win my bread every day.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I was caught by a tweet by John Hussman who said, think of the EU in its current malstructured form as a kind of Ponzi scheme, and Britain is the guy who just asked for his money back. I like that, very pithy. But you're saying that there's a structural problem. We've all known there's been a structural problem. In the euro itself, it is a monetary union with a structural problem built in. I mean, do you agree with that? But secondarily, what does this mean for the euro as a currency?
Well, sure. First of all, we got structural problems everywhere, right? We love to point the finger at the easy solution. We got structural problems in the U.S., we got them in the U.K., we got them in the EU, we got them in the euro. And I do like to point out one of the reasons why the U.K. was able to kind of vote to leave. And by the way, they've only voted to leave. They haven't given formal notice. I don't actually think they'll do that for an extended period and so forth. But it is so much easier for the U.K. to leave than any member of the eurozone. If Spain or Italy or Greece were to leave, then anybody who has money in these countries would take the deposit and move it over to Germany or one of the other countries. So you'd get the money be sucked out of the financial system. And yes, now in recent days, banks have declined in value more so than the overall indices. But you would see a far more severe capital flight if that were the case. Now it's just, quote unquote, bad for financial markets. But it would be truly catastrophic for the countries in those to actually leave. And that's why Greece hasn't left, because they haven't had the guts to pull the plug. And you could argue that it would be less painful for them to leave, but they would see a collapse of their financial system. For the Brits, that's not going to be the case, because they're outside and they have their own banking system. They have their own regulatory environment. They have their own currency. And so for them, they just have to deal with the consequences. But breaking the euro apart is not something that's going to happen at the beginning of this road. It might happen at the end of this road if many bad turns are going to happen. Now, some people, the optimists, saying, oh, people wake up and now finally they're going to make the right decisions. And I like to hope that. Having said that, there has been plenty of opportunity during the peak of the eurozone debt crisis to make the right decisions. And yes, that has happened through a coerced kind of movement to force governments to do some of the right things. But the underlying structure reform, I haven't seen how the EU is capable of doing that. And which means that Europe has been around for 1,000 years, the EU not quite obviously as long. It will be around in some form or another. The question as investor is, where do you want to be in that game? Do you want to be where everything is quote unquote right and perfect and realize that isn't so perfect either? Or do you want to be where there's blood on the street and there might be good value? And I'm not suggesting you should buy things right now, but it's not always that easy to just say, hey, it's a mess over there, I have to stay away from these things.
Well, let's talk about that mess a little bit, and this is part structural, and I'm interested in exploring how this is a little bit like 2008. I know there's some big differences and some similarities. Love to get your views. But I'm looking at some real hemorrhaging in the bank, insurance, and brokerage stocks, especially the European counterparts for the U.S. issues over there. This is starting to, it feels to me there's a lot of smoke coming out of the banking sector with, I'm looking at the stocks here, STOXX. So there's quite a bit of hemorrhaging going on with some sub issues under there, really, maybe even some flames going along with the smoke, Deutsche Bank, a number of others. What is the chance that yes, there's some political issues, but what is the chance that there's a real financial accident brewing here?
Well, we know the playbook of central banks, right? They provide liquidity. Central banks can keep a zombie banking system afloat. They've shown that in Japan. They've shown it in the Eurozone in the aftermath of 2008. They've shown that in the U.S. But they've also shown that they cannot fix structural issues. When you have ultra-low monetary policy, that's okay maybe for a short-term thing. You cannot fix structural issues with monetary policy. And similarly, of course, the Brexit is absolutely a structural thing. You cannot fix that with easy money. Now, that won't stop central banks from trying, especially today's breed of central bankers. Can bad things happen where we are? Well, we've had one of the reasons why so few people slept from Thursday to Friday, including us, is because you have such a tremendous amount of derivatives outstanding, so many things outstanding, and people bought protection. I mean, you bought put options, and put options got expensive. And so you use these proxies to do things. And as people are unwinding some of these positions, a lot of knee-jerk reactions can happen to banks. Now, do I think the banking system is going to blow up as part of that? I don't think so in this context, because we have forced banks to take on so much less risk. The problem with that, of course, is that they're also not liquidity providers now, which means you can have more severe movements in the markets, and the quote-unquote blow-up might happen elsewhere. It might not happen in the financial institution that the Fed, the ECB, or the Bank of England is supervising, but it might happen in a commodity trading house that's not supervised. It might happen in some insurance company that's outside of some of the regulation. It might happen elsewhere where you are not looking for the actual trouble. And while we're discussing, oh, it's going to happen here, something else is brewing, and some other disaster, black swan, is going to happen elsewhere. And so that's the sort of thing when you have these more pronounced moves that you want to be on the lookout these days. And overall, again, as I said earlier, this all happens on the backdrop of markets that are expensive. Central banks have pushed up asset prices everywhere. And so now we're letting the steam out from that. And of course, that's going to have ripple effects as well. And there we have the similarity to 2008, when you have to liquidate things. Other bad things will happen as well, because you're going to liquidate what's most liquid rather than the bad stuff. And to just take it a step further, you mentioned some specific names. I don't want to endorse any of these or talk badly about any specific one, but why would you want to work for any of these banks these days? If you're in the city of London, you might lose your quote-unquote passport to do business in the rest of the EU. So they'll set up a subsidiary in Dublin, probably. You don't want to do it in Frankfurt because they talk about transaction taxes. You don't want to do it in Paris because your income might be taxed at over 100%. But Dublin has awful weather. And so the folks in London, these hotshot young guys that are very smart, well, maybe they just don't want to move and work in banking anymore, and they're going to move to other industries. Now, long-term, that may be a very good thing, that they'll do real things rather than financial engineering, but that's going to cause that industry to suffer. It's going to be a brain drain. And again, in a world that needs liquidity, we're not going to have it as much anymore. And a credit-driven society is dependent on a well-functioning banking system. We can hate the banks all we want, but if we live in a credit-driven society, we're kind of stuck with them. And so you better make sure this stuff works. And I don't see much moving in a direction that is actually fixing the things that we need to fix these days.
Well, speaking of that well-functioning banking system, I have to confess, a lot of Europe doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Like Italian sovereign debt yields, particularly, you know, as of before Brexit, out to 3 years, negative yields on Italian debt. So when I hear that Italian banks are sitting on some 360 billion euros of bad loans, I think Italy's banking system has a solvency problem, not a liquidity problem. And yet the ECB just keeps pretending as if more liquidity and higher bond prices will do the trick. I mean, good Lord, come on. The FTSE Italy Bank Index is down 27% since the Brexit vote. Again, isn't this telling us that that there might be a fire along with all that smoke?
Well, there's certainly a problem. I had a discussion with a former Fed president a few months ago, and who kind of told me, I mentioned earlier, that, well, Main Street doesn't give a damn what Wall Street does. And because we were discussing this thing about why is Janet Yellen so afraid of raising rates, because raising rates tightens financial conditions. Well, that just happened, right, earlier this year. But it was, of course, too much. Why would the Fed or the ECB be concerned about having asset prices come down? The S&P coming down shouldn't be an issue for the Fed. And he said, well, except if they created a bubble, then it is a problem. And he just left it at that. He didn't say that we created a bubble. But what's happening now at the ECB is that, I mean, you mentioned, Bloomberg just said that globally, we have now more debt yielding negatively than the entire global corporate bond market. And that's just stunning. I mean, obviously it's the sovereign debt that's mostly negative. And one of the things with Draghi saying that, you mentioned Italy and so forth, we're saying that, we're gonna buy a corporate debt now. Well, guess what? The liquidity isn't there. There isn't enough debt around. And so guess what? Because they know the ECB is going to buy stuff, let's buy derivatives. Let's buy CDS. And by drawing the parallel to 2008, that didn't work out so well in those days. And more importantly, even because they pushed markets to such extremes and coerced investors to go out and buy longer dated and riskier securities than it otherwise would. Well, if we ever have this market turn, well, guess who owns the problem? It's the central banks that own the problem. And the question is whether they can go and fix it. And so back to your question, whether if there's fire where there's smoke, well, yeah, it's kind of, I mean, we are in a it is quite smoky out there. The question is what sort of things will break and so forth. I just happen to think that the banks themselves, they can be kept alive. The fallout is going to be elsewhere. And the fallout we're seeing right now is capital misallocation, that all this is inducing investors to put money in the wrong spots. And yes, that can have a violent unwinding. Will the system itself collapse? Maybe, but that's not my base case scenario right now.
Well, here's something that I don't understand. I'm hoping you can address. So if the ECB does take some losses on its balance sheet, how does it true those up?
My silence that was there for a second answers the question. Technically, the EU says that the member countries have to then pay in more capital in order to make up for the losses. That's the theoretical answer. Now, in practice, rules are there to be broken. Mm-hmm. A central bank, if you didn't have that arrangement, there is nothing that says that a central bank cannot have a negative net worth. The Bank of Israel has had a negative net worth for over 20 years. It's all just fiat. It's all just accounting entries. And so a central bank is perfectly allowed to have losses and so forth. It's just the EU has these rules. Now, as we've seen in Europe, the accounting rules can be changed. Oh, we hold the stuff to maturity. We don't have to market to market. We do this or that. Oh, we'll offset that with future gains. I mean, what happens in practice, we'll see. And some of these things, we've had these transfers to Greece, and everybody says, oh, the Germans are on the hook. Well, if we had a true fiscal union, we would have these as bona fide payments to the weaker countries, and now it's a potential loss. Does it really matter? Politically, there are different implications for it, but yes, losses have incurred, and somebody's got to pay for them. And guess what? It's going to be the taxpayer in the end. And to just take it a step further, because we love to talk about Greece and the Europeans, globally, governments have too much debt. Mm-hmm. And governments that have too much debt have an interest in debasing the value of that debt. And that is very different from your interest or my interest as an investor. We have savings. We want to preserve the value of our investments. And so the messaging of all of that is we may love or hate of what our politicians do, but they don't work in our interest. They are trying to preserve the status quo, and that works in different dimensions. So don't count on the central bank of bailing you out. They will bail out their respective governments. And unfortunately, today's governments have different interests than the citizens of the people. And that's one of the reasons you have this populist uprising. But to you as an investor, it means that, yeah, don't think your government is going to take care of you. You got to take care of yourself.
I totally agree. I'm just confused how financial repression could possibly work mathematically on a global scale, because everybody can't devalue their currency at the same time, right? Except against what? I don't know what. Commodities? But, you know, we've just had, the worst return in commodities in 80-plus years in this most recent period. I'm still confused about how that how you devalue globally. I don't get that.
Well, if you're not confused, you're not paying attention. You take the Dark Ages, right? Things didn't work so well during the Dark Ages. Things were dysfunctional during the Dark Ages. Bad things can happen. I'm not suggesting bad things will happen, but clearly the debasement of the currency hasn't worked so well. And the Japanese have learned that. And at the same time, you can induce inflation, and you can induce inflation in many different places. The question is, where do you seek protection? As you pointed out, commodities haven't done so well. Gold has done reasonably well, but we've also seen that gold can come down from $99 to near 1,000, right? And so there isn't one thing that will do well. The one thing that does happen when you have financial repression and the sort of environment we're in, you have to adjust your portfolio asset allocation to throw out the risk-free component. There is no place to hide. You live in a risky world, and your investments are risky. And so you have to navigate through that. And the short of that is that if you're sophisticated, you can deal with it, and you have a portion in gold, you have a portion diversified, whatever it might mean. But if you're the mom and pop saver, you're gonna lose out. And similarly, I happen to believe if you do a traditional asset allocation and say, oh, everything is gonna be dandy if I just have the 60-40 allocation, equities and bonds, I happen to believe that you're gonna lose out, because everything in quotes has been pumped up in asset prices. And so, quote unquote, everything can deflate. You want to look for things that have a low correlation to the stuff that has been inflated and has a positive return expectation. It's one of the reasons why gold comes to mind. It has a low correlation. And then if you think we have financial repression, that means real rates are zero to negative. That means this brick that doesn't pay anything might not be so bad. But of course, most people don't have everything in gold. So what else do you do? And very quickly, you go to more complex strategies that you're short things or have a long short strategy. And that's the sort of thing that most people are not so comfortable with. And that makes this thing very, very difficult. And so part of the goal of central banks has been to push people to take on risk, but it's backfired badly. And we see people now we got the Brexit thing coming up, and that's a deflationary force where we have war turmoil. And I think it's going to be a while before we come to our senses.
Now, let's talk about gold in that context. One of my favorite topics. It seems to be doing well here. It's notably decoupled from the dollar. We had, I think, in British pound terms, one of its best showings in decades. Hedge funds and managed money boosted their holdings of gold to a record right in the days before Brexit. They seem to have gotten that right. First, your views on gold going forward. Second, did the bullion banks finally get it wrong?
Well, when everybody piles into gold, I kind of get a little bit concerned that, mm-hmm. Are we overdoing something? Are we due for a correction? Having said that, they've piled into gold for the right reasons, right? I mean, we have a world that's less stable, but you got to be careful about short-term pullbacks. I never really like to buy gold because of an upcoming event, you have a revolution somewhere, this or that, because we tend to look beyond that at some point. Now, in this case, though, I happen to think that we've changed the dynamics globally. A taboo has been broken, and therefore we'll have more events like the Brexit vote. And so from that point of view, I very much sympathize with that. We have seen interest in gold broaden, and I think that's, and also think about gold is one of the things that, in my view anyway, is cheap compared to many other things. And so, yeah, just from a pure diversification point of view, there might be a reason for that. What's going to happen from here onward? Well, who knows? It really depends on whether the market is going to shrug this off and move on. I happen to think that that's a rather, rather unlikely scenario, that finally we found a way why the market should deflate. And if it's not this, I can give you a very different reason why I think the markets are going to tumble in the not so distant future. But for the time being, yes, I do think that the diversification to gold has made a lot of sense to a lot of people. Now, whether the bullion banks have gotten it wrong, you might want to clarify what you mean with that. You probably are alluding to some conspiracy theories. So before I answer that question, maybe give me some more detail and I'll try to address that.
Oh, no. When I just, tracking the commitment of traders, when the commercials get this short, they very, very rarely lose. There's almost always a they always seem to win. If that's a conspiracy, I don't know. But when the commercials get this short, it's you're usually due for a big pullback in the price of gold, but not this time. So it seems like they might have got caught on the wrong side of an event. I'm just wondering your views on that.
Well, the commercials are usually not, well, by definition, not speculating, right? And so they do these things for business reasons. And they need to hedge their expenses. They need to do this and that. And so even if they quote-unquote lose, they do it so that they can be in business. And one of the things that has been changing is that if for many years, the mining companies, for example, their key interest was to increase the number of ounces. They didn't worry about profits. They didn't do this and that. And now that the price of gold had come down quite a bit, they're scrambling, many of them, to survive. And so some of them have introduced hedges again and so forth to just be more prudent in the risk management in their own operations. Now, as an investor, we may not appreciate it because we want these things to be great when the price of gold goes up. But it's just one of the reasons why investing in mining companies is different from investing in the metal. You take on different risks, and sometimes you only know with hindsight of what sort of strategies that the commercials have undertaken.
Yeah, well, I'm a big fan of gold for a variety of reasons. I don't invest in it because of inflation. I invest in it because of financial uncertainty. To me, it was a guarantee that at some point we're going to have a variety of currency accidents and Minsky moments and maybe institutional failures and maybe a sovereign default somewhere along the way. That, to me, that's just the outcome of what happens when you expand debt, underlying debt in a global economy at 2, sometimes as high as 3 times the underlying rate of income growth in the overall economy. To me, you just have a math problem at some point. The only question is, how does that resolve? Heck, I don't know. So gold to me is the insurance against the idea that eventually there's a pin. You know, all bubbles are in search of a pin. Was Brexit a pin? Maybe, but you know, it's not a fundamental pin. There's no fundamental reason why Brexit is going to change the earnings outlook for Caterpillar 3 years down the road, to me.
So what if I can chime in on that just for a second.
Sure, please.
Yeah, you talk about sovereign defaults. I have long thought that the entire morphing of the Eurozone is about getting the Eurozone strong enough to be able to stomach a sovereign default. And I think we've come a lot closer to that. If Greece were to go bust now, I think the Eurozone would survive that much more. Ultimately, as I indicated earlier, and I think you agree, we've made too many promises, meaning we have too many obligations out there. And so those obligations will need to be renegotiated. And different regions in the world, different countries, we'll do that renegotiation differently. And so in the US, we like to use the printing press, the Germans like austerity, the Japanese like the three arrows. And so this will have different implications for different sort of markets. And as an investor, you want to decide where you want to be on some of these things. So when this thing that's renegotiated, that you end up on the better side of things. And yes, gold is a simple answer for that. Because gold doesn't in itself have counterparty risk. Now, it does have counterparty risk the moment you touch it, you try to store it, or you try to do something else with it, but in itself, it doesn't have counterparty risk. And so clearly, when assets, the validity of assets get questioned, be that a currency, be that a sovereign debt, yes, gold does quite well. But again, you can do some of these things by buying timber. You can do some of these things by buying commodities, and as we or even equities to an extent, because you have an ownership in a company. But as we have well seen as well, that commodities can go down, equities, well, maybe equities can go down after recent years. You think they can never go down again? I happen to think that you want to still have a prudent way to diversifying in these assets. And you and I probably have a bigger allocation of our portfolios in gold than many others. But it doesn't mean the price of gold will go up every day. And investors, when they think about the risk profile that they have in their own portfolio, they always need to be aware, am I comfortable with that sort of exposure? If the price of gold were to plunge substantially, would I be okay with that? And if not, then you're overexposed to it. If you're okay with that, and usually that happens when you have other sources of income, well, then that's fine. You can have a much bigger than usual allocation to something. And I heard again right after the market plunged on in the aftermath of the Brexit, oh, don't worry, don't panic, and don't sell. Well, the time to sell is before the panic. After the panic has happened, you've lost a substantial portion of your net worth, and odds are that you cannot afford to invest in as risky a portfolio anymore, and then yes, it is prudent to take things back rather than to double down, even though the markets might rebound. And so it's about the sort of risk that you can bear, and if you can afford the risk of being in something that's potentially expensive, like Bay Area real estate where I live, well then go for it. But if you can't afford it, then hey, take your profits and move away.
Absolutely. So tell us in the time we've got left, what are you keying on? What are you watching for in this week as it unfolds? What's got your attention most?
Well, I do want to see whether this market rolls over. I called early August last year, I said, I'm coming out as a bear. Mm-hmm. And that was before the turmoil in August. And then we've gotten very close to reaching the highs of last year. And then the Brexit so-called bailed me out, so that we're now again having a bigger chance of a bear market than a resumed bull market. I still happen to believe we're in a bear market. We do have to firmly get into bear market territory in the S&P 500, I believe, to get some sanity back into this. And I really don't think it would be healthy for the markets if they shrug this off. I do think that this is so fundamental that it will have to topple over. And so I do think equities will be are going to see how they act. Now, clearly, usually what happens when you have severe volatility in the market, you also have these snapback rallies. So it's going to be interesting to see how that unfolds. It really depends on what type of investor you are, whether you want to focus on the short term or the long term. But in the short term, there's going to be volatility in many of these markets. This is the time where investors want to look at what stuff did well and what stuff did poorly, and have a really honest discussion with oneself. Am I diversified? Because if somebody preached to you, hey, you're diversified if you are in both technology and healthcare, well, guess what? You haven't been diversified. And so are you diversified? Do you have enough things in your portfolio that will get you through what might be a rougher ride ahead? And so what we do internally, we look at sensitivity analysis. We said, all right, these are the sort of diversifications we have, and this is what we expected would happen. And now we do a cross-check. Well, oh, this stuff was much more volatile than we anticipated. Is that likely to persist? And if so, do we make adjustments in our portfolio?
Now, it's been fascinating to me to see the degree of correlation across the world markets really drive. I mean, for a while on Thursday night, I got confused whether I was looking at a chart of the British pound or the S&P futures because they were so similar just in appearance. How does one, really, you talked about being really well diversified, and you're not diversified if you have, oh, I don't know, healthcare and technology shares. But are you even really diversified if you have, a good smattering of bonds and stocks from across the globe at this point in time? That is like, what would an average investor who wants a real diversified portfolio need to do at this point, besides hunker down in cash and have a few high quality bonds, a little gold, and hope for the best?
Well, stress test your portfolio. I think that's really it. And I mean, I've been quoted when I said, oh, you need to have at least 20% of your portfolio in alternatives. I think that's way too low, actually, especially in the current environment. I mean, some university endowments have 60-70% in alternatives. And you mentioned the deduction that we own an equity fund. Well, we shut that down before I came out with my call to be bearish the market last year. So I can go short the markets. I didn't want to do something I don't do for my investors. And so I've been short the equity market since last August. And obviously we do some risk management in between and increasing and decreasing those things. Now, most investors, I cannot advise the general public to go short the equities because A, I'm not allowed to give specific investment advice. And B, it may not, you have what's called a negative carry, right? There's a dividend yield. And so you're really fighting the market by being negative on that. And so that's why the entire industry always tells you to be long. But what you can do is you can reduce the overall risk profile. You mentioned cash. I mean, I don't like dollar cash, but it's probably better than many other things out there. It's not the worst decision that you can make. Gold. Yes, I like gold. Investors should look whether that's appropriate, whether more than the kind of what's often mentioned, a 5% allocation is appropriate. I happen to have much more than 5. But I can't give specific investment advice. And then it goes, as I indicated, very complicated. We do long, short currency strategies. Hey, I love that stuff, but most people don't understand it. So can I tell people you've got to have that in your portfolio? You've got to be careful because you're then telling people to have things that they don't understand. And that's probably worse than being in something that might go down in price. And so there is no easy solution. So what investors can do is they can listen to folks like you to try to get educated and then try to make smart decisions. And if they don't like what they see, yeah, I mean, if nothing else, raise some cash, because at least you're, quote unquote, only losing the purchasing power of that cash.
All right. Well, fantastic. Well said. I'm sure you've got a very full plate today. I know I caught you on the West Coast, so you're talking to us very early your time. I do appreciate it. And thank you, Axel, for just an illuminating discussion. I can't wait to see how this all unfolds. You're just a gem. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Have a great week.